Hello, folks. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Federalist Files. We're going to be going over number 78 today. It is titled The Judiciary Department, written by Alexander Hamilton, June 14th, 1788. Topics include all statutes are to be deferent to the Constitution, Supreme Court is to be keepers of the Constitution, case law, most recent, is to be the one that's solidified in the current law and given the supremacy. Judicial branch must be independent from the influences of the other branches. Superiority of the Constitution and the people over the government. Now, this is by far, I would say, my favorite Federalist paper. It is an introduction to the judiciary, and it does really outline the power that the Constitution has over the legislative body and how it's representative of the people, and how the Supreme Court is supposed to believe and be independent of those two other branches, the executive as well as the legislative branch, but really how the Constitution is superior and supreme over these other branches, and how the Supreme Court is supposed to be endowed to the, or rather have their, they're supposed to be responsible, accountable to the Constitution. So this paper, it begins the examination and the endeavor of the judiciary branch. Hamilton lays out several objects. First is the mode of appointing judges. The president would nominate the judges in this case. It's the same situation as the officials and the ambassadors and the ministers and the government. It's the same one that we went over the last couple of papers. You would have the nomination come from the president, and then the Senate has to go forward and they have to confirm the appointment. Currently, a majority is needed for that in the Senate. Second, the tenure in which they hold their seat is a life term, and Hamilton explains as long as they hold their officers during good behavior. So he explains it here. He states, and I quote, and this is to open up the entire paper, and just want to preface all this. This paper is a long one, so this will probably be a pretty long podcast, but I think it's going to be very worth your time. And it's a really good way, especially near the very end, now that we know the composition of the government and how it is to be run, now that we know the superiority of the Constitution, and if you want to amend that Constitution, it does need an extraordinarily amount of, almost like an extraordinarily Herculean amount of power coming from the, not the government, but from the people, from the direct representatives of the people in the state governments, which he's going to go over in this one. So this one will probably be around at least 40 minutes, I would assume. So he starts off, he states, and I quote, "The manner of constituting it seems to embrace these several objects." He's talking about the Supreme Court. "The mode of appointing the judges, the tenure by which they are to hold their places, the partition of the judiciary authority between different courts and their relations to each other. First, as to the mode of appointing the judges, this is the same with that of appointing the officers of the Union in general, and has been so fully discussed in the last two papers that nothing can be said here which would not be useless repetition," which I stated before. Now, second, "As to the tenure by which the judges are to hold their places, this chiefly concerns their duration in office, the provisions for their support, the precautions for their responsibility." So Hamilton, and this is where Hamilton actually kind of gets to the good behavior in continuance of the office. He's claiming that, and he goes on to kind of explain why, especially near the very end, he claims that this is the most valuable factor in the judiciary authority in the Supreme Court. So he remarks, and he said it's also one of the most valuable improvements in modern practice of government. So he states, and I quote, "The standard of good behavior for the continuance in office of the judicial magistracy is certainly one of the most valuable of the modern improvements in the practice of government. In a monarchy, it is an excellent barrier to the despotism of the prince. In a republic, it is a no less excellent barrier to the encroachments and oppressions of the representative body, and it is the best expedient which can be devised in any government to secure a steady, upright, and impartial administration of the laws," end quote. So yes, this does establish a security to the people. It establishes a security that there's not going to be a law that counteracts the Constitution without being challenged by the Supreme Court. The only problem, the one thing that he does mention in this paper about the Supreme Court is if it gets tainted in its composition by the executive or the legislative authority. And I'm going to go on to actually explain how this relates to modern politics in this one. So Hamilton, he explains that in terms of the three branches of government, the judiciary, and I quote, will always be the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution because it will be least in a capacity to annoy or injure them, end quote. So yes, this is assuming, and this is really the problem. This is assuming that there's not a politicization of the Supreme Court. So if there is no politicization of the Supreme Court, it's not a problem, right? Now, if we have a Supreme Court that's going against and contradicting directly the Constitution, then this is where we're going to run into problems because then the Supreme Court becomes a super legislature. And that's kind of what we're seeing in our modern day politics, unfortunately. He was making the assumption, Alexander Hamilton. He was making the core assumption that the values of the Constitution would be upheld above everything else. There would be a deference to the Constitution, and the loyalty would be to the people in the Constitution, and the Constitution is supposed to represent the people. It's the self-government action. And that's just, unfortunately, in today's day and age in modern politics, that's not the case. This also was not the case years ago when they continued to uphold slavery. They continued to uphold segregation, government segregation. So we've had the Supreme Court be derelict in their duty many times in history. It's been egregious in the past. It's continued to get better in some fronts, and then in other fronts, it's continued to get even worse. In terms of Second Amendment cases, especially being one of them, probably the most significant, and First Amendment, freedom of religion as well. So Hamilton, he notes that the executive holds the sword, while the legislature holds the purse and prescribes the laws by which citizens live. Whereas the judiciary doesn't really have any of those things in its power. And he goes on to explain why the judiciary should not really be in a position to injure or hurt the people or the Constitution. He states, and I quote, "Whoever attentively considers the different departments of power must perceive that in a government in which they are separated from each other, the judiciary, from the nature of its functions, will always be the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution, because it will be least in a capacity to annoy or injure them. The executive not only dispenses the honors, but holds the sword of the community. The legislature not only commands the purse, but prescribes the rules by which the duties and rights of every citizen are to be regulated. The judiciary, on the contrary, has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction either of the strength or of the wealth of the society, and can take no action or no active resolution whatever. It may truly be said to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment, and must ultimately depend upon the aid of the executive arm, even for the efficacy of its judgments," end quote. So when he says the aid of the executive arm in the efficacy of its judgments, yes, that's the executive's job, is to enforce the law, and that's kind of what he's referring to there. What he's saying is, in the judicial authority, all they are meant to do is to judge the merits of laws being attempted to be passed and make sure that they add up, especially in the terms of the Supreme Court, that they add up to the Constitution, that they are, they're comporting with the Constitution as long as they're within the regulation of the Constitution and they're not antithetical to the Constitution. Then there shouldn't be any issues, and that's all their job is. Therefore, they don't have the same power that the legislative authority does or the executive branch does either. But really, what we're seeing is we're seeing a dereliction of the duty in the Supreme Court to uphold laws. They won't even take cases that are constitutional cases. And that's kind of the problem that we're running into right now. We have a bunch of people that are kind of spineless. Not all of them, but a lot of very, I'd say a majority of them in the Supreme Court are very spineless in their practice. And that's actually, he talks about fortitude. In this paper, he lists it, and obviously intentionally, that these Supreme Court justices need to have intestinal fortitude. So Hamilton next, he predicts, and I quote, "Individual oppression may now and then proceed from the courts of justice. The general liberty of the people can never be endangered from that quarter. I mean, so long as the judiciary remains truly distinct from both the legislature and the executive, end quote. So this is actually probably the most significant, especially in terms of relating it to modern day times. This is the most significant quote there is in this entire paper. It actually sums up what is going on in the Supreme Court and why we're having such problems in the judiciary department, is they have become hyper-politicized, and they've been politicized by the far left. The far left, for the most part, has a, I'd say, there's a 5-4 majority in terms of, I'd say, Second Amendment. I wouldn't even say that First Amendment. There's a 5-4 majority. There isn't right now a 5-4 in the Supreme Court in terms of what I've seen from the First Amendment. And the Second Amendment's the only thing they're probably solidly winning on. In other cases, it seems like there is a liberal, actually, because you have Kavanaugh, you have Amy Coney Barrett, as well as John Roberts. So pretty much there is a 6-3. There's Alito, Gorsuch, and Clarence Thomas that are the three. They're the more on the conservative side. And then you're seeing people that actually were appointed by Donald Trump in a Kavanaugh and a Coney Barrett. And they've kind of sided, especially on social issues, they've sided with the progressive movement, with the leftist movement. Therefore, and John Roberts just isn't even, I mean, he's wish-washy. Everybody knows he's really just a liberal in there. Therefore, we really don't have a majority. Everyone likes to think it's because Trump appointed three Supreme Court justices. We really don't have a majority, and I don't know if we'll ever have a Supreme Court justice as solid as like a Clarence Thomas or a Samuel Alito ever again. I just think in this day and age, culturally, I don't think it's actually possible. Unless if they maybe appoint a guy like a Ted Cruz, I'm not really sure, or appoint a guy that is like a libertarian, hardcore conservative. I just don't know of any judge that is like that. So, and that's the problem. There's been a politicization of the Supreme Court, and they want to add to the Supreme Court. They want to pack the court system because as soon as the Democrats start losing, that's what they have to do because they're authoritarians, and they know that they can use, instead of actually passing law, they'll just use specific cases and case law to create a super legislative authority within the Supreme Court. You only need those 9 people. You only need a majority of those 9 people to confiscate weapons or to invalidate the Second Amendment, tell them that somehow rifles don't fall under the Second Amendment. You can have that done in the Supreme Court, and then that automatically means that you have outlawed rifles in the entire country if you come out with a decision on calling and saying that rifles are not supported by the Second Amendment. That's one court decision away. We almost had that in Heller versus DC, and I think I want to say it was maybe 2012. It was for individual gun ownership, and I think it was only a 5-4 vote that just passed by. So, just to remember, if you want to read, I mean, I know the Second Amendment by heart: a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. If you want to just look at that very last part, that shall not be infringed part, it is pretty clear cut. There is nothing to support, even in these Federalist Papers. You're not going to find anything to support a big gun grab, that rifles are not considered, not something that falls under the security of the Second Amendment or the protections for the citizenry of the Second Amendment. You just can't find anything that supports that. Meanwhile, we had 4 of our Supreme Court justices in 2012 voted against individual gun ownership. So we're really only a couple votes away. We're one court case away from having individual gun ownership rights stripped from us. And I think that's why people fight so hard. Realistically, in law, they can say it's illegal by the Supreme Court, but it's whether or not people are actually going to comply with that, which I don't think they would. But it definitely sets a very bad precedent and destabilizes the entire country. I could say that much, because people aren't going to just hand over their guns willingly to the government. So he goes on to state now, Hamilton, he infers that the permanency of office would keep the judiciary independent of the two branches. He states, and I quote, "And it proves in the last place that as liberty can have nothing to fear from the judiciary alone, but would have everything to fear from its union with either of the other departments, that as all the effects of such a union must ensue from a dependence of the former on the latter, notwithstanding a nominal and apparent separation that as from the natural feebleness of the judiciary, it is in continual jeopardy of being overpowered, awed, or influenced by its coordinate branches, and that as nothing can contribute so much to its firmness and independence as permanency in office, this quality may therefore be greatly, therefore be justly regarded as an indispensable ingredient in its constitution, and in a great measure as the citadel of the public justice and the public security, end quote. So yeah, he's once again reiterating that having these lifetime terms and permanency in office makes them not no longer makes the Supreme Court justice no longer reliant on the executive authority or the legislative branch, and then they can work independently, and really their loyalty is to the people and the Constitution is the most important part. It's to try to mitigate any type of influence that would come from the other branches, which I think they did a very good job in doing so. I think actually the real problem that people are, these Supreme Court justices in general, I think they're actually afraid of Antifa and BLM coming after them. I really do. I think that there's we're starting to see like a ruling by the mob, pure democracy, and I don't really even want to call it that, but a ruling, it's a mob rule mentality. I think that these people, that these Supreme Court justices get death threats from Antifa, they get death threats from BLM, and I think they act on a lot of those death threats and the whims of others, because they're actually afraid for their family and their lives, which is unfortunate, but I do think that is the truth. And there's some sort of cultural, they're looking for some sort of cultural clout as well, I think, that if they, especially Justice Roberts does this all the time, he'll vote whichever the way the media wants him to vote, because he wants to be seen in the eyes of the media as some exalted one, some good guy. And really all that means is that he doesn't have fortitude, he has no conviction, and he's spineless and he's a coward. So next he goes on, he states, and I quote, "The complete independence of the courts of justice is peculiarly essential in a limited constitution by a limited constitution. I understand one which contains certain specified exceptions to the legislative authority, such, for instance, as that it shall pass no bills of attainder, no ex post facto laws, and the like. Limitations of this kind can be preserved in practice no other way than through the medium of courts of justice, whose duty it must be to declare all acts contrary to the manifest tenure of the Constitution void. Without this, all the reservations of particular rights or privileges would amount to nothing," end quote. So yeah, he's saying because of the Constitution, it limits the authority of the legislature in certain specific ways. And the reason to have the Supreme Court is to interpret that Constitution. And he gave some examples. There's some exceptions to the legislative power, no ex post facto laws, no bills of attainder, things of that nature. And the executive branch, or rather the judiciary branch, is there to make sure the legislative authority doesn't change those laws on a whim without a review of those laws, and compare it to the Constitution and say, well, this doesn't comport with the Constitution, so this is no good. If it conflicts with the Constitution through the judicial power, the House of Representatives and the Senate can't really do anything about it. And I think that's the most important thing. In other words, they are the keepers, protectors, and interpreters of the Constitution. The duty of the judicial branch is to interpret the Constitution and declare acts contradictory to the Constitution invalid. And Supreme Court especially, if you're going to go superior courts or state courts, then they look at their own Constitution in a lot of these cases, as well as the federal Constitution. Hamilton defends the above statements by arguing that the representatives are not superior to the people they represent. And I think this is actually a very core fundamental value of the Constitution and self-government, and it's extremely significant. He goes on to state, and I quote, "There is no position which depends on clearer principles than that every act of a delegated authority, contrary to the tenor of the commission under which it is exercised, is void. No legislative act, therefore contrary to the Constitution, can be valid. To deny this would be to affirm that the deputy is greater than his principal, that the servant is above his master, that the representatives of the people are superior to the people themselves, that men acting by virtue of powers may do not only what their powers do not authorize, but what they forbid, end quote. So this is the most important part. I'm going to try to break this down in the simplest and illustrate this the best way that I can. What gives the legislative authority, what gives a House of Rep member any type of power to begin with, is the Constitution. So they cannot circumvent the Constitution because that's the document that already gives them power. It cannot change the authority of the Constitution, considering the Constitution, it is the kingmaker in this case. It is the gatekeeper. It makes the legislative authority, makes the executive authority, makes the Supreme Court. For that reason, there is nothing that the legislative branch can do to circumvent the Constitution, because the Constitution is the one that gives them those powers to begin with. The judiciary will work as a limit on the power of the legislature and keep that branch limited. So he's going to go on to kind of explain this in another way as well. He states, and I quote, "If it be said that the legislative body are themselves the constitutional judges of their own powers, and that the construction they put upon them is conclusive upon the other departments, it may be answered that this cannot be the natural presumption. Where it is not to be collected from any particular provisions in the Constitution, it is not otherwise to be supposed that the Constitution would intend to enable the representatives of the people to substitute their will to that of their constituents. It is far more rational to suppose that the courts were designed to be an intermediate body between the people of the legislature in order, among other things, to keep the latter within the limits assigned to their authority," end quote. So this even states that the judicial branch is also not above the authority of the Constitution and the governing document, which is the Constitution. And they're really supposed to be the intermediary between the legislative authority, say, okay, this is kind of within your constitutional power, because the Constitution is, in essence, a inanimate object that doesn't speak out for you. So you have to have these people that interpret that object and say, okay, well, this is what the Constitution says. You guys want to do this. This is strictly unconstitutional. You don't have the power to do so. And they go, oh, well, I can change the Constitution whenever I want. Well, who gives you the power and the authority to do that? It's a contradiction in and of itself. Who gives the legislative body, who gives a senator the power to approve of any type of law? It's the Constitution. So they cannot go ahead and pass law that contradicts the document that gives them the power to pass that law. In essence, it's a giant, it's like turning around just like as soon as you get out the womb, slapping your mom in the face. That's the best way I could try to explain it. That's my most rudimentary way of explaining it. So Hamilton stresses that the Constitution is to be regarded by judges as fundamental law. So next he states, and I quote, "A constitution is, in fact, and must be regarded by the judges as a fundamental law. It therefore belongs to them to ascertain its meaning as well as the meaning of any particular act proceeding from the legislative body. If there should happen to be an irreconcilable variance between the two, that which has the superior obligation and validity ought, of course, to be preferred, or, in other words, the Constitution ought to be preferred to the statute, the intention of the people to the intention of their agents," end quote. So yes, if you have two laws that are conflicting, it's the Constitution and it's a gun-grabbing law. You look at the Constitution and you say, Constitution has superiority over every single law that any politician wants to pass. So automatically, by default, the deference goes to the Constitution. Therefore, this law that's conflicting with the Constitution is voided, is really what he's saying. There's always going to be superiority to the Constitution above all other law. It's the law of the land, as it's even stated, I believe, in the Constitution. I mean, in the Constitution, it's supposed to be considered the law of the land. And that really is the case. There's specific states have specific rights. It's laid out in the 10th Amendment. But in particular, as it relates to the First Amendment, freedom of speech, a well-regulated militia, Second Amendment, those things cannot be infringed. It even says in the First Amendment, actually, there's something very similar in the writing, fundamentally, to the Second Amendment, it is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Notice the law, the language of abridging nothing. They make no law respecting or prohibiting free exercise thereof. There's very common language, very similar language in the First and the Second Amendment, which are probably the strongest out of all of them, I guess, if you look at the Bill of Rights. Fourth Amendment also as well. It's a pretty strong one. But yeah, for the First and Second Amendment, they say specifically, they lay it out, this is an amendment, this is something that cannot be infringed by the government specifically, which is very important if you ever have a debate with liberals when they try to sit there and sell you that you should hand over your guns to the government. You should just say, shall not be infringed, at the very end of the Second Amendment. So, the Constitution ought to be preferred over statutes by the legislative body. This provision supposes that the power of the people is superior to both. The legislature does not have the power to abolish the document, as in the Constitution, that has given them power and is superior to them. Hamilton characterizes the role of the judiciary. He states, and I quote, "It is far more rational to suppose that the courts were designed to be an intermediate body between the people and the legislature, in order, among other things, to keep the latter within the limits assigned to their authority," end quote. Yeah, so that's something that he stated before, I'm pretty sure. Yep. Okay, so Hamilton importantly refers to the practice of case law. He states, and I quote, and this is very important as well, "When determining between two contradictory laws, it is the job of the judiciary to reconstruct their meaning and operation." He states, and I quote, "Where this is impracticable, it becomes a matter of necessity to give effect to one in exclusion of the other. The rule which has obtained in the courts for determining their relative validity is that the last in order of time shall be preferred to the first. But this is a mere rule of construction, not derived from any positive law, but from the nature and reason of the thing." So, end quote. So, really what you're saying, what does that mean exactly? Whatever the ruling is by the Supreme Court on some sort of, whether it's a, let's say it's a constitutional issue, the Supreme Court, whatever the ruling is, that is now set as the precedent of law. And that's why we get into this discussion about a super legislature, because the Supreme Court actually does make law by determining cases, case law, determining constitutional provisions. They do actually, in essence, kind of have a power to make law because of this. So once they set that precedent legally, that is the law until another court case comes up. And then that's, let's say there's some sort of court case that conflicts with this current law in place, then they kind of duke it out, the Supreme Court, and they figure out what they're going to do with the decision. And then whatever happens, whether it's the new standard that's adopted or the old standards stand strong, that is really the precedent for law and how certain laws are supposed to be interpreted. So Hamilton continues that this is not a rule that has been forced upon them by the legislature, but adopted by themselves as a consonant to truth and propriety for the direction of their conduct as interpreters of the law. So he continues next, he states, and I quote, "But in regard to the interfering acts of a superior and subordinate authority of an original and derivative power, the nature and reason of the thing indicate the converse of that rule as proper to be followed. They teach us that the prior act of a superior ought to be preferred to the subsequent act of an inferior and subordinate authority, and that accordingly, whenever a particular statute contravenes the Constitution, it will be the duty of the judicial tribunals to adhere to the latter and disregard the former," end quote. So yeah, he's talking about the Constitution specifically. In terms of some sort of, if a court case comes up, they're going to have to kind of look at both, but usually they adhere to what the, he's saying if they figure it out that the latter, this new subsequent act, or this subsequent act has some sort of subordinate authority, then they determine to hold a precedent as whatever the superior, which was the one before. But the very original derivative power in terms of the Constitution, that's a whole different story. that's supposed to have deference above everything. So yeah, it's a little convoluted, it's a little confusing. I understand that, but in terms of the Constitution, I think it's pretty clean cut in those cases, because the Constitution generally, especially the Bill of Rights, deals with the authority of the people and the rights of the people. So the Supreme Court should always be in favor of the people having more rights than trying to take them away, which we really haven't. I went over this court case a couple weeks ago. The Supreme Court decided to kick it back down and hold on to whatever the state, what the state courts, what their decision was on the woman that was a florist and didn't want to serve a gay wedding. They said she had to. So by law, she has to give her labor to a gay wedding, because or else it's discriminating. But it's against her religion. So now we're prioritizing homosexuality above someone else's religion. That's really what's going on. And obviously their property and their business. And the Supreme Court said that was okay. That's acceptable. Which it's not acceptable by the First Amendment. So it just doesn't make, once again, we're kind of getting into this really weird confounding of principles by the Supreme Court. It's not all of them. It's like I said, it's probably six of them feel that way, and the other three don't feel that same way. So if you can't uphold religious freedom, then I don't really know how far we're going to last here. If you're telling people by the end of at the end of a government gun that they have to provide services to something that they just don't believe providing services in, to begin with, I'm of the opinion that in a general sense, if you run your business, you can provide services to whomever you want to, whether you want to discriminate or not. It doesn't, to me, it doesn't matter, because if you're discriminatory in your behavior, then you're actually losing customers, and then word gets around, especially in today's day and age, word gets around that you don't serve a specific race, or you don't serve a specific, sexuality or whatever, what have you, then you'll lose your entire customer base. So especially now when there's much more accountability because there's social media, all these corporate woke corporations genuflect upon the gay pride flag and all these other things, those are they should be able to reject whoever they want as a business owner. That's just within their right. That's within their property rights, and that's within their freedom rights. The government can't tell you who you have to, who you can and can't serve, because the government doesn't own your business. Now we're kind of getting into this weird situation where it's like the government owns business. That's kind of how they're handling things from now on. So this is a significant excerpt from the paper solidifying and signifying the power of the rights of the individual citizens and the Constitution as being supreme to subordinate authorities. Next is another important factor that the judges may substitute their own pleasure to the constitutional intentions of the legislature. And this is very interesting. And this does relate to today. So Hamilton, he stresses, and I quote, "The courts must declare the sense of the law, and if they should be disposed to exercise will instead of judgment, the consequence would equally be the substitution of their pleasure to that of the legislative body. The observation, if it prove anything, would prove that there ought to be no judges distinct from that body," end quote. So yeah, you should have really. If the judge decided to exercise their will, which we're seeing from Sotomayor, we've seen it over and over again, they exercise their will instead of their actual judgment on these cases, because these things are objective, they're not subjective. A lot of these things are objective reality truth. If you know anything about the Constitution, the Constitution, the framers, all the debates that they had in writing the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, if you read anything, then you would know these things are just objective realities. A lot of these things, especially Second, First Amendment like deals, and you see them consistently be derelict in their duty in the Supreme Court. And that's really what he's kind of saying here, is you have people that if they just go by their will instead of the actual judgment objectively looking. So the will meaning, let's say Amy Coney Barrett doesn't believe in gay marriage, right? But she recognizes under the Constitution that it's completely legal and you can't imprison somebody for that. That would be a judgment under the Constitution, because there's nothing that defends and calls for putting people in prison for being homosexuals. But her will personally, she would say, "Well, I don't approve of homosexuality." And that's really, and let's say she made now homosexuality completely illegal in some sort of a court case, just because that's her own will. There's nothing in the Constitution that signifies that that's okay, right? And that's what he's referring to here. He's saying that you would have nothing better than just a legislative body. You just have a bunch of crap. You just have a bunch of just bullshitters, really, on the Supreme Court. So this is another appeal to the reader that judges shouldn't be derived from or impacted by the legislative authority. But Hamilton also expresses his fear and portends that judges can become legislators in their duties if they fall to their own preconceptions and predilections rather than interpreting the law as it is written. This activism from a Supreme Court justice can cause a significant fracture in the Republic and jeopardizes the freedom of every single citizen. Next, Hamilton explains the superiority of the people as well as the Constitution above the legislature. Hamilton respects and he trusts the Constitution as the fundamental principles of Republican government and the right of the people to abolish and alter their own established Constitution whenever they find it inconsistent with their happiness. And this is really the most important part, that the people hold the superiority over the legislative body, and they are the only ones that are really able to alter and fundamentally change the Constitution. Hamilton, he states, to the people's power, he states, and I quote, "Until the people have, by some solemn authority, act annulled or changed the established form, it is binding upon themselves collectively as well as individually, and no presumption or even knowledge of their sentiments can warrant their representatives in a departure from it. Prior to such an act, but it is easy to see that it would require an uncommon portion of fortitude in the judges to do their duty as faithful guardians of the Constitution, where legislative invasions of it had been instigated by the major voice of the community." So yes, he's saying the people are the only ones that really have the right to establish a new form of government or to abolish the Constitution, eradicate it completely, or alter it, right? When he says that, you say, well, then how would they go about doing it? Because don't they have to go through the legislative branch? And yes, this is true, but they would have to go as well to their own state legislators, which is actually, they probably hold, the state legislators in this case hold the most power, and this isn't a democracy-like system. This isn't a majority vote to alter the Constitution. You're going to need 2/3 of the House of Reps, which are supposed to be representative of the people, and then 2/3 of the senators as well, which was supposed to be more representative of individual municipalities within the states. And then additionally, you're going to need 3/4 of all the state legislative branches throughout the entire country. At that time, you know, 13 states, let's say, to do so. So this is much more of an act of the people. That's why he's kind of characterizing it more of an act of the people, because you really do need a very large chunk of a majority. You don't just need the majority. You need a much higher percentage. You got 66% in the federal legislative branch. And then your state legislative branch, you're going to have 3/4 of the states all in agreement, which is 75%. So it's a way higher bar to have a constitutional amendment or to abolish the Constitution. So next he states, and I quote, or let me see. So in other words, the judiciary is to provide fortitude on behalf of the Constitution, even in times of turmoil, when the legislature is attempting to take advantage and violate the provisions therein. The people, if they want the Constitution annulled or edited, they need to conduct an act in order to change the Constitution. It is not the job of their representatives to alter the document that supersedes their authority. The judiciary also has the power to handle infractions that, and I quote, extend no farther than the injury of the private rights of particular classes of citizens by unjust and partial laws. As no man can be sure that he may not be tomorrow the victim of a spirit of injustice by which he may be a gainer today, and every man must now feel that the inevitable tendency of such a spirit is to sap the foundations of public and private confidence and to introduce in its stead universal distrust and distress. So really what he's trying to state here is the judicial power, they have the responsibility of making sure there's no partial or unjust laws for particular classes of citizens, which right now there's affirmative action, which goes against what white people and Asians. So that's kind of a law that is, that one's unconstitutional according to this. Other than that, I don't really know of any other ones. So Hamilton next, he asserts, and I quote, inflexible and uniform adherence to the rights of the Constitution and of individuals which we perceive to be indispensable in the courts of justice can certainly not be expected from judges who hold their offices by a temporary commission, end quote. So he's saying to hold true to these values, to hold true to the Constitution, to have that true accountability to the people in the Constitution, they need to hold their offices for life terms. It can't be done on a temporary commission. This is an appeal to the permanency of judicial offices to ensure protection of individual liberties. A pivotal role of the judicial branch is the protection of the private rights to extend and protect all citizens from oppressive, partial laws that only affect specific classes of citizens. Therefore, the judiciary is instrumental in the role of defending the rights of the citizen and ensuring stability in governing and the justice system. So in conclusion, Hamilton, he expresses that in a free government, the code of laws will be voluminous. In order to avoid an arbitrary discretion in the courts, it is imperative that the judges shall be bound by strict rules and laws or standards. That being said, Hamilton cites integrity, sufficient skill in law, requisite knowledge, and ability to meet the demand of long and laborious studies are essential skills that a judge must possess. So he kind of goes on to just talk about, in a general sense, the skills that a judge needs to possess. He states, and I quote, "There is yet a further and a weightier reason for the permanency of the judicial or the judicial offices, which is deducible from the nature of the qualifications they require. It has been frequently remarked with great propriety that a voluminous code of laws is one of the inconveniences necessarily connected with the advantages of a free government. To avoid an arbitrary discretion in the courts, it is indispensable that they should be bound down by strict rules and precedents which serve to define and point out their duty in every particular case that comes before them, and it will be readily be conceived from the variety of controversies which grow out of the folly and wickedness of mankind that the records of those precedents must unavoidably swell to a very considerable bulk and must demand long and laborious study to acquire a competent knowledge of them," end quote. So yeah, he's saying in a free country, free government, you're going to have a lot of laws. You're going to need these people to be well-read. They're going to have to be very intelligent. They're going to have a lot of integrity, just all the general things. Now, because of these life terms, he says this is paramount. He states, and I quote, "A temporary duration in office, which would naturally discourage such characters from quitting a lucrative line of practice to accept a seat on the bench, would have a tendency to throw the administration of justice into hands less able and less qualified to conduct it with utility and dignity," end quote. Yeah, so this idea of temporary duration in office is just stupid. It needs to be a life term, obviously on good behavior, as long as they don't commit any felonies or crimes or do something crazy. So he ends, and I quote, and he actually kind of just, he summarizes, we got this provision, we have this value from Great Britain. He states, and I quote, to end, "Upon the whole, there can be no room to doubt that the convention acted wisely in copying from the models of those constitutions which have established good behavior as the tenure of their judicial offices in point of duration, and that so far from being blamed on this account, their plan would have been inexcusably defective if it had wanted this important feature of good government. The experience of Great Britain affords an illustrious comment on the excellence of the institution," end quote. So I guess Great Britain at this time, they kind of just recently implemented this institution, their Supreme Court, life terms. So the analysis of this paper, I mean, everything was so long here, it was so copious. There's a lot of notes I had to put into it. It's very complex when it comes to the judiciary. We're going to have our next one on the judicial branch as well. It's just going to be continued from this. It'll probably be just as long. Hopefully, maybe I'll try to make it a little shorter. But this is the introduction. It's very important. I highly suggest you check this one out or you send it to other people. This one is actually probably the most important in terms of really the philosophy behind this Republican form of government, the federalism form of government, and how important and significant the Constitution is and the power that it holds above our representatives and our senators and our presidents and our Supreme Court justices. So I greatly appreciate everybody tuning into this one. Please like, share, subscribe, drop the mic, let people know about the podcast, and I will see you all next time. Thank you.